This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices, episode 295, was recorded on October 28th, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective, because the funds sit in escrow. Evergreen GavCal founder David Hay returns as this week's feature interview guest, when the topic du jour will be greenflation, along with the usual macro suspects such as stocks, precious metals, and bond yields. Then be sure to stay tuned for our postgame segment when Patrick's chart deck is titled What's Going On in the Bond Markets.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. Eric, that S&P 500 had exactly like a 24-hour market correction that lasted just a quick moment, and we're back up toward the 52-week highs. This thing just keeps going. Any insights on your end?
Well, I'm going to discuss that with David Hay in today's interview. You know, I have really come around. I used to say years ago that, look, this whole thing has been driven by central bank largesse. It's unsustainable. It can't last forever. Surely there's got to be a moment of reckoning when we're going to have a stock market crash. I don't think so. I think it's a melt up into a crack up boom. And I think it's an inflationary Great Depression, a greater depression, that is ultimately the big price that we pay for all of this central bank largesse. But we're not there yet. We got a long ways to go. And I think the stock market keeps on grinding higher.
All right, well, let's take a look at the dollar index. Down 50 cents today, a bit of a reaction now in ECB and the euro. What's your take on the dollar?
Well, Patrick, I really don't think there's anything to say. You know, we're between 89 and 94 and a half. I really don't try to swing trade it or anything. I don't have a view other than we're consolidating in a range. And until we break out of that range, I think we're just trading sideways here.
All right. Let's talk crude oil. First of all, how did the inventory numbers come in? And then let's talk about that little pullback. I mean, we had about a $5 pullback off the highs over a couple of days. Is this a buy on dip?
Patrick, I do think it's a buy on dip. We got down to the 21-day moving average, touching it exactly, and that has been what has caught this market for, I don't know, the last however many corrections. And we closed above the 13-day. We need to get above the 5 and the 8. If that happens tomorrow, then I'd say we're headed back toward new cycle highs. As far as what's going on, though, it's really important to understand that Cushing, Oklahoma is having an oil inventory crisis. So this week's EIA inventory had crude oil building 4.3 million barrels nationally. But wait a minute, Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 3.9 million barrels. So, you know, around 4 million barrels, but it's opposite directions. National building, Cushing drawing down. What's going on is the ARBs are open out of Cushing to the Gulf Coast. They're drawing a lot of oil out. There's been a pipeline that I can't remember if it was a pipeline reversal or just a capacity increase that has contributed to all this. I don't really follow all the details in the physical market, but there's pipeline stuff going on contributing to this. And what it means is Cushing, Oklahoma is really about to run out of deliverable oil. Now, the key word there is deliverable. There's lots of oil in those tanks in Cushing, Oklahoma. In fact, they're still at about 30% capacity, or almost 30% capacity. The thing is, the WTI contract, which settles in Cushing, that's a specific grade of crude oil. And if the crude oil that's in those tanks is not that grade, if it's not deliverable against that grade, it means it can't be used to settle that contract. If you run out of deliverable oil in Cushing, anything could happen in terms of manipulations of price and all kinds of crazy stuff. That's in the next few weeks. Now, at the same time, the old saying is high prices cure high prices. We've got massively wide time spreads at the front of the WTI term structure. That creates a huge incentive for anybody who's got any oil to deliver it into the front month contract. That would be what saves the day. But it looks like we're really going to run pretty close to running out of oil in Cushing in the next few weeks. So it's going to be really important to watch. That could rocket the front month price to the moon. Anything is possible there. U.S. production, 11.3 million barrels, unchanged. And again, it's going to be really interesting to see what this Cushing situation does to the price of WTI. It could turn the Brent WTI spread upside down. A lot of things are possible. But again, high prices cure high prices. And maybe this is all going to get resolved as people respond to those prices by delivering more oil into Cushing.
All right, well, let's touch on gold. It's above 1800, but then it's not. And then it is, and then it's not. So what's going on here?
Well, Patrick, you said it all. You know, I'm seeing all the gold bugs are on Twitter saying, look at the breakout. It's a breakout. Wait a minute. Look, a breakout is when something moves above a key technical level and then the price action accelerates from there and it takes off. What we've seen here is gold poked its head above the 100-day and 200-day moving average, which are co-located just below 1800. And they got one daily close above, then there was a daily close below. Then there were two daily closes above, it looks like today, but not by very much. I want to see, you know, another $10 of upside beyond this and have the price stay meaningfully above that cluster of moving averages. Right now, we're seeing a, you know, a sort of kind of want to try breakout, not a real breakout. I'm still holding my breath.
All right, let's touch on that 10-year yield. It's interesting that on the 10 and the 30s that we're seeing pullback in the interest rates while it's changing at the front of the curve. We'll talk about it in the post game, but right now we tested 170 the other week on the yields, and we're pulling back here to about 150. What's your thinking on interest rates?
Well, 170 has been the line in the sand that we've seen. That's where people in the past have started to freak out. In this case, we got there, and I don't know that anybody freaked out, but the market's turned around. We don't have people this time. Last time we got to 170, there were all kinds of voices saying, okay, this is it. Bond market crash is on. The bond bear market that's going to go for the next 35 years to replace the bull market of the last 35 years has begun. I don't hear those voices anymore. So it seems like maybe the panic is down on that line in the sand at 170. Maybe that means there's room to go farther. I don't know.
Well, this week's feature interview guest is Evergreen GavCal founder David Hay. Eric, why did we get David on the show this week?
Patrick, as you know, secular inflation has been the topic that I think is most interesting, and we've talked to all of our guests about it. David's been writing about what he calls greenflation. I don't want to steal his thunder, so I'll let you wait for the interview to hear what that is, but I think it's a fascinating concept, and I think it's very much apropos to the markets today.
Well, Eric's interview with David Hay is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was brought to you by Abex, a fintech company traded under ticker symbol ABXXF on the OTCQX in the United States and ABXX on the Equitas NEO in Canada. Abex was founded on the principle of creating market-based solutions to solve the world's most challenging problems. Two of these issues in particular, the energy transition and climate change, are creating once-in-a-generation opportunities for investors. Abex is leveraging proprietary Web 3.0 technologies to digitize and accelerate the velocity and security of commodity trading markets, beginning with liquefied natural gas and carbon. Investors seeking exposure to the fintech applications powering this new era of the ESG economy can visit www.abex.tech or www.abex.exchange, or check out ABXX on the Equitas NEO or ABXXF on the OTCQX exchanges.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is David Hay, founder and co-CIO of Evergreen GavCal. David, it's great to get you back on the program. I've been asking everybody the same question as an opener, which is, okay, inflation. Are we talking secular structural inflation, which is what I think, or do we believe Janet and her friends in the government who say it is transitory? So I want to get your take on that, but particularly, you've been writing about something called greenflation. What the heck is greenflation?
Well, first, Eric, thank you very much for having me on the show. It's a privilege, especially since I just listened to your podcast last week with one of my heroes, Luke Groman. And he did not talk about greenflation last week, even though he's written on it somewhat. So I appreciate the opportunity to talk about that because I think it's hugely important. And I think it plays a significant role in this debate about whether inflation is transitory, as the Fed is saying, or it's much more enduring, which is, I'm with you on that and Luke. And, you know, frankly, based on the Fed's forecasting record, which is horrific, you know, I think the fact that they're saying it's transitory is probably a pretty strong indication that it's not. Maybe once they finally concede that it's here for years, that'll be the time to take the other side of the trade. But basically, the idea of greenflation has to do with the reality that the planet is involved in a great green energy transition. And just one key element of this, which I think is inarguable, is that this is the first time in human history that we're moving from more efficient fuel sources to less efficient fuel sources. And I'm aware of, you know, of all the environmental reasons why we're trying to do that, but that doesn't change the fact that it's extremely daunting to make this happen, and especially on the very ambitious and, I'd say, overly ambitious and unrealistic timeframe that policymakers around the world are trying to achieve. And we're seeing the wages of this already with tremendous energy inflation occurring in Asia and Europe. I think most Americans are unaware. We have natural gas that's doubled. Natural gas is trading for around $6 per million British thermal units, MMBTUs. But in Asia and Europe, it's $30 or more. So you've got, you know, really a shocking amount of energy inflation occurring, and real risks of rationing and outright shortages that could take lives if the winter is cold, as a lot of forecasters are predicting in Europe. So, we've got this war on fossil fuels, where you've got a number of American cities that are trying to prevent natural gas being utilized and fighting the transmission of hydrocarbons, you know, pipeline shutdowns, even existing pipelines. Yeah, there's the New Yorker gave the platform to a Swedish professor who's written a book on how to blow up pipelines. He's avidly recommending that people go out and blow up energy pipelines. It's just unbelievable that he would be given that kind of a forum. But regardless, I mean, obviously we know that U.S. policy is very anti-fossil fuels. So guess what? This is the first time in history that we've seen huge price spikes without a supply response. So we're still are at a point in this country where the drilling rig count is inadequate to offset the decline rate in the shale area, which is, of course, where we've had the tremendous growth of both natural gas and crude oil, is because of shale. But as you know, Eric, and a lot of people don't, shale has an extremely rapid decline rate. So you have to drill a lot just to stay even. And that's hard to do when you've got pressure from your investor base about ESG, and you've also got pressure to not make those investments, but rather to buy back shares, which these companies are doing. So all these things are feeding this greenflation type of thing, and it's not going away. It's going to be with us for years to come, you know, whether it's right or wrong.
Well, I have to confess, this is the first time I've heard the particular phrase greenflation. I agree with you.
Well, good. I created that. I'd like royalties because I'm starting to hear some other people use it. I'm teasing, but
well, you know, yeah, I think I want to push back a little. You've come up with a very catchy. I love the name, but I think what the gist of what you're saying is, hey, green energy is going to be more expensive, and it's an understood thing that we're trying to make the planet a better place, and it does mean you're going to have some additional expense. But if green energy costs more, then obviously the cost of energy is an input to the cost of everything. I think you've made that
Precisely.
Point, but I also think you just made a different point, which I personally think is even stronger. And I'll call it not greenflation, but really stupid policyflation. And that is where you say, look, let's vilify the oil industry. Let's take the people who are producing energy the old way, the kind that pollutes the environment, which is the only way we knew how to do it a few years ago. The people that are still in that business, let's make criminals out of them and let's punish them and treat them like bad people. And whatever we do, let's make sure that we never, ever, ever invest money in their companies so that they can create more of those polluting resources because we have to clean this planet up. Okay, great. So you've just taken the people that are your lifeline to run the economy on, and you've turned them into the villains, and you've cut off their funding so they can't make any more oil wells in order to keep up the current supply. And you've also got this pipe dream that the whole world is going to be driving Teslas in 3 years, which is just not real. Where's all of this headed?
All very well said, Eric. It is kind of mass insanity, and that is what I'm seeing around the world in so many ways is just these policies that are illogical, irrational, you know, borderline lunacy. And it's not that it doesn't make sense to try to emit fewer pollutants. It obviously does. But I mean, what you're seeing is as these energy crises hit in Asia and Europe is a surge in coal usage. And of course, coal is one of the worst forms of fossil fuels that you can use. I mean, CO2 is not a pollutant, but N2O, nitrous oxide, which comes from burning coal, is an extreme pollutant. And really kills people. Another thing that's bizarre about this is that 2 to 3 million people die every year in the developing world because they don't have access to clean burning fossil fuels such as natural gas and propane. So actually, U.S. energy industry is making a big shift to export large quantities of propane to, for example, Africa, so they don't have to burn dung and wood and other, you know, nasty things in their little homes, which is terrible for people's health. So really, I think you're right. I mean, it's like we're treating the energy industry like the tobacco industry 20 years ago. I actually wrote one of our newsletters back in December called Totally Toxic, that, you know, instead of saying, hey, this, we need that, we can't run our planet this day and age without energy. So to demonize this industry, well, guess what? They're going to say, we're not going to produce. We're just going to, I mean, they'll drill a little bit here and there where they have fantastic returns, but we're not going to get that typical supply. You know, I'm a big believer that the cure for high prices is high prices, but that's not going to happen in this environment. And that's why I believe that the greenflation is going to be quite persistent.
Now for the challenging part, David, let's take these ideas and talk about how to translate it to an investment strategy, because I see this as very difficult. One of the things that's going on here is oil companies are not getting investment from funds because ESG mandates are basically vilifying them and saying don't. In theory, that ought to mean that those oil companies are exceptional values because they're not getting the buyers from the funds, and therefore, you know, you can buy them on the cheap and it's a fantastic deal. But wait a minute, I'm not sure it's a fantastic deal to buy something on the cheap if there is this somewhat insanity-driven public agenda to treat those industries like criminals, even though that we're dependent on them for the lifeblood of the economy. So does this mean that investing in oil companies is an incredible opportunity because they're undervalued right now? Or does it mean it's a dumb idea because they're going to continue to be the victims of all this?
I think it's the latter, Eric, and I'll tell you why. And again, this relates back to the newsletter I wrote, Totally Toxic. If you went back and bought Philip Morris 20 years ago, you would have absolutely crushed the S&P. I can't give you the exact data off the top of my head, but it's immense. And so what, and that was, you know, those guys produce products that actually kill people, not that are essential to the operation of industry and, you know, basically maintaining human welfare, which obviously fossil fuels have been incredibly beneficial at over, you know, ever since they were invented. The energy density of gasoline, for example, is just remarkable. But the reality is, even with you know, a horrible product for the last 20 years, they've been phenomenal investments. So I think that's what you're setting up for. But what they did was they basically decided they're just going to raise prices. They're not going to go for market share. And they're going to buy back immense amounts of their own stock and raise dividends. And that's exactly the model that the energy industries are already following. So what you're seeing is that a number of these companies have 15% free cash flow yields, and even in the mid-20s for some of the mid-tier operators. And so, yes, I think those are going to be very good investments for years to come. And I think the fact that so many different types of investors around the world won't touch them is actually a good thing for the contrarians. So I would argue it's a very good setup for years to come with energy, despite and maybe because of all the hostility towards the industry.
Now, I'm just going to push a little harder on that, because if I think about what you said, is it really an opportunity for those energy companies, which are going to be the ones that are victimized by stupid government policy? Or would it be smarter to say, no, I'd actually rather bet on just energy prices, buy the crude oil, buy the commodity, rather than the companies that produce it?
Well, it's a good point. And I think the answer is yes. In fact, to your point, what's interesting is the futures curve in oil. So right now, oil is trading in the mid-80s, WTI, Brent's a little closer to 90. And yet, if you were to go out to 2023, 2 years from now, it's $15 a barrel lower. And if you go out another year, it's $20 a barrel lower. So you could buy those futures contracts and just let them go. And you're going to get a high rate of return just having it converge to today's spot price, which I actually believe is going higher. I think prices are, instead of going lower, as the futures curve implies, they're going higher because we have an extreme shortage of oil right now, and it's getting more and more acute, which is exactly what the futures market tells you. When you have that kind of what's called backwardation, where the spot price is so much higher than the futures price, it's telling you that the market's in an extremely tight, even deficit supply situation. By the way, the International Energy Administration or agency, IEA, has drastically underestimated the demand of crude oil for years. And that number today is about 2.8 billion barrels. That's how much they've underestimated demand They continue to do it. People continue to focus on their numbers, which is amazing. They've just been as inaccurate, frankly, as the Fed has with their economic forecasts. But it's an important point in this way regarding equities is because equities are based upon earnings estimates, right? Forward earnings estimates. And the forward earnings estimates are a function of the futures curve. So those earnings estimates are incorporating, you know, $65 a barrel oil. And if it's just going to maintain where it is now, those earnings estimates are going to come up drastically. And I think that's exactly what's going to happen. And I think that's going to be your next up leg in this energy bull market that has been playing on. I mean, a year ago, Jim Cramer was telling the world energy is uninvestable, and he had a lot of company. And yet, you know, what's been by far the best performing sector this year, I mean, not counting cryptos. Energy is up over 50% this year. Even the midstream pipelines are up over 50% this year. Who'd have thought that at the beginning of the year? Well, we were pounding the table on energy back last December when I wrote that Totally Toxic newsletter. So it's still very much of a contrarian play, and I think it's going to stay a contrarian play, frankly, and that's kind of the good news. And plus, as you know, the dividend yields on many of these companies are extremely high.
Let's move on to the stock market more broadly and just talk about where equities are headed because, boy, you know, there's so many reasons. I mean, the last time we had a taper tantrum from the Fed, I mean, it was a big market crash and everybody was afraid the bond market was going to crash and the world was coming to an end. We've gotten to a point now where it seems pretty darn clear that the equity market can shrug off just about any news and keep marching higher. Is that just set to continue because of central bank largesse, or do we have a day of reckoning ahead of us? And as we address that, you sent me something this morning talking about a Paul Tudor Jones quote, talking about range expansions. What's a range expansion? How does that fit into the story?
Well, that is his term. It's something that we've used with different terminology for years. I think it's the best way to make money and avoid losing money, if anything I've ever stumbled on. And I do think most people in the industry just intuitively get it, that when something has a major breakout, let's go back to the S&P. One of the biggest mistakes I made in my career was when the S&P had its big breakout over the 2000 high back in either 2012 or 2013. It was around 1550 on the S&P, a clear breakout to an all-time high, and I missed it. At that point, I was worried that the Fed was, which was already doing QEs, was artificially stimulating, and that there would be a day of reckoning much sooner than has turned out to be the case. So, bad mistake to have missed that warning. If you want to look at one today that's giving you a tremendous buy signal, look at what's happening with the Japanese stock market, which recently made a 28-year new high. And so in our way of looking at the world, and I think Paul Tudor Jones would agree with this, the longer the range has been in place, or the trading range, basically just if something's been oscillating between 20 and 40 for many years and it goes to 42, that's telling you that something has changed and it's likely to keep on running. So that's really what it means. But Paul Tudor Jones said something to the effect is that when a range expansion happens, whatever it is going to keep trending in the direction of that range expansion, which is just another way for us to say if something's breaking out, it's likely to keep going. And oftentimes it's really quite a big percentage move after the breakout occurs. And what's really interesting and relevant to the images that I sent you earlier, which are to do with the economy, things like inflation or the jobs market, that when you see these breakouts occur, let's say with inflation, that was a big warning sign earlier this year that the Fed was wrong about inflation being a flash in the pan. So it's amazing. It's almost like fractals, in math and fractals in real life, that you see this pattern replay itself time and time again. So, for your listeners, I think one of the key takeaways, and again, I've learned it the hard way over my 42-year career, is that breakouts and breakdowns are hugely important. And you could see that in some of the Chinese stocks earlier this year when they broke below multi-year, below where they were even during COVID. And that's a classic sell signal. So hopefully I covered that.
Okay, David, that covers a definition or an explanation of what these range expansions are, but help me connect that to the current stock market, because it seems to me if I look at the S&P chart, I don't see a sudden breakout out of a trading range that has existed for a long time. What I see is a march straight up for like 10 years that I think is driven by central bank policy, and I thought it couldn't possibly last this long, and clearly I've been wrong. Where is the breakout here?
I'm right there with you. I don't think any rational person would have believed 6 or 7 years ago that we would still be not only doing QE, but that we're actually doing MMT, modern monetary theory, which is, that is one point that I'd like to make, because I hear people say, well, they're doing QE. They're not doing QE. They are doing full-blown MMT, and that's what's different versus 10 years ago. As you're aware, I think it was Dylan Grice you had on back a number of months ago, and he was saying, geez, you know, I really blew it back in the, you know, the early 2010s because I saw this money being printed and I thought it would be inflationary. And it was asset inflationary, but it didn't create CPI inflation. But this time is very different because not only is the Fed creating trillions of dollars of their magical money, but it's actually getting spent by the federal government. Federal government has spent $14 trillion since COVID started, which is about $1.2 billion every hour. It's a pretty sobering statistic. About $7 trillion of that $14 trillion has been deficit spending. So, and the Fed has bought a large degree of that. Now, some of that has gone into mortgage-backed securities, but I don't think it really matters. As long as the Fed is buying securities with fake money, it's really debt monetization. And that is, of course, the hallmark of MMT. And the proof that we're doing MMT is that Stephanie Kelton, who is one of the founders of the whole MMT School of Economics, if you can call it that, is very happy with what the Fed and the federal government's doing. And of course, we have another multi-trillion dollar spending orgy coming up here with, you know, it's going to get downsized a little bit, but it's still going to be a shocking amount of money. The folks at Invesco say that the money supply, which has already increased by $5 trillion since COVID, is going to increase another $3 trillion. So it's a very inflationary set of circumstances that we have currently. And it, you know, I think if you look at the history of MMT, Eric, what you'll see is that you get this initial asset boom because there's just so much money sloshing around. France did it back in the early 1700s, and they had a terrific stock market boom. And then, of course, real inflation showed up. That's always the Achilles heel of MMT, which even people like Stephanie Kelton admit. And they say, well, when it happens, you know, you can raise taxes. Okay, well, maybe they can raise taxes a little bit, but or the Fed can start tightening. And I think that's the real fallacy. I mean, the Fed's always telling us that they can tighten if necessary to control inflation. I think in this environment, their ability to tighten is almost nil. I mean, they have truly, you know, the old saying, they painted themselves into a very tight corner. In the Fed's case, they printed themselves into a very tight corner.
If you go back to so many smart people in, let's say, you know, early 2010s, 2010, 11, 12 in there, lots of smart people were saying, look, this rally has been driven by central bank largesse, and there's no free lunch, and it's certain that a big crash is coming someday. I used to believe that very passionately, and boy, I've been wrong for a full decade. I've come around to a different view, which is, yeah, the part of that story that was right is this all comes to a very, very sad ending someday. But I think it is more likely to be an inflationary Great Depression where the direction is up, not down in nominal stock prices, because what's happening is that inflating currency is causing people to flee to hard assets like real estate and precious metals. But of course, the biggest asset class that you could escape into would be the stock market. So I think it is a very, very big day of reckoning that's coming, but I don't think it's a crash. I think it's a melt-up that sets off just an unbearable inflation. Does that make sense?
Well, I would say yes. I actually think that you're onto something. If you look at the history of inflation in stocks, is that stocks struggle, at least most stocks struggle, when you go from low inflation to rising to moderate inflation. Interestingly, we haven't seen that yet, right? I mean, the stock market's up 23% this year, the S&P, even though inflation is clearly going from low to more moderate or to high moderate. So that hasn't happened yet. Now, maybe it will, but it's interesting that if you use the 1970s as a template, the stock market did very poorly, but hard asset-based stocks did extremely well. And I think that is the more likely outperformer over the next decade are those that are resource, basically that are scarce. They own scarce assets. And, you know, and that's one of the things, if you've ever heard Tony Deaton interviewed, brilliant man that Grant Williams, my great friend Grant Williams, has interviewed multiple times. And Tony Deaton says, invest in scarcity. Well, what's not scarce? Certainly not treasuries, which are being created at an unbelievable clip, or the U.S. dollar. That's not scarce. So I think you want to be invested in scarcity. And I think a lot of U.S. stocks aren't scarce. I mean, with all the IPOs that are occurring and, you know, just the and going to quasi stocks with things like SPACs that are being created overnight. And so I think it's a two-tier market, basically, Eric. I think there's parts of the market that are absolutely nuts. And ironically, those are the parts that don't do well with rising inflation, you know, these highly speculative securities, because rising interest rates, which, you know, comes along with inflation, tends to be very hard on high multiple securities. And it tends to be much friendlier on those, value plays that also have scarce assets underlying them. So I think you're right, though. I don't think we're going to see, you know, the typical, you know, grinding multi-year bear market. I think what we're looking at are kind of these flash crashes. I mean, obviously what happened back in March of 2000 was one of the greatest buying opportunities of all time, but it happened in about 3 weeks. And really, like 1 week toward the very end, toward like between March 15th and March 23rd, that was really the great buying window. You had to move fast. And I think that's the way it's going to be the next time we have a market problem, because I'm convinced. And by the way, one of the reasons that we went bullish back in March of last year was because the Fed did what I'd been saying that they were going to do for several years, which most people thought I was crazy about, which was that they were going to target credit spreads. They would actually start buying corporate bonds to bring credit spreads down. And that's what turned the market, you know, back on March 23rd of last year. Well, this time I would go so far as to say, I believe in the next bear market, the Fed's going to buy stocks. They will print money to buy stocks, which is another way of saying, I think you're right. And I think because they can pull that off, that will, again, rally the market. Interestingly, they didn't have to buy that many bonds. They only bought about $18 billion worth of bonds. Just the fact that they told the bond market, we've got your back, I think kind of the same thing's going to happen with the stock market. Once people say, hey, the Fed's in there buying stocks, we'll buy stocks. So, you know, if you get a 15, 20% pullback, I think that's about it for the time being. Now, eventually, at some point, I mean, obviously, if inflation becomes too much of a problem, then every time the Fed says, we're going to print to do this, you know, that instead of being beneficial, it's counterproductive. And I think they're at that point in the bond market, but in the stock market, they could still have a huge impact.
David, you mentioned that quote from Paul Tudor Jones, who I'm sure most of our listeners know is an extremely famous futures trader, legendary name in the industry. I was really surprised by a quote that I saw, I think it was on Zero Hedge or someplace, saying Paul Tudor Jones supposedly said that in the next reckoning that he thinks cryptocurrencies might do better than bonds as a safety asset. Boy, I was really surprised by that. I'm going to go out on a limb here and suggest that perhaps I might personally understand tokenized secure digital bearer assets, including cryptocurrencies, a little better than Paul Tudor Jones does. But you know what? I'm a great big nobody in the world of finance, and he's a great big somebody. And when you get people like that saying cryptocurrency is the future, it's going to be awfully difficult for governments to outlaw it. So I'm really wondering what's going to happen with this crypto craze. I think it's a craze more than a good idea, but it's taking on proportions much larger than I ever thought possible. What do you think?
Well, I'm right there with you. I mean, obviously, Bitcoin's got a market cap equivalent to Tesla, $1 trillion, for something that is just this kind of amorphous item. And I'm not at all denigrating the blockchain technology and that's not going to be a big part of finance going forward. I think it will be. And I think Bitcoin's a survivor. I think Ethereum's a survivor. So those things have, I do think there is, I mean, obviously, there is this built-in scarcity. So getting back to what I said about Tony Deaton, so Bitcoin's got that going for it. The problem is, I think the rest of the crypto universe or crypto space is very questionable, and certainly in terms of scarcity. I mean, Dogecoin, which got up to a market cap of $80, $90 billion here this year, I mean, it's just a joke. The founder admits it's a joke, and it's created an unlimited supply. A lot of these things have unlimited supply. Plus, you can obviously come out with, and I think there's something like a dozen different Dogecoins now. So that's the problem there. And the other problem is Tether, which is something like half of all Bitcoin purchases occur using Tether. And Bloomberg Business Week just had a cover story on Tether and basically pretty much recapped a newsletter that we put out back in the summer called Untethered that used a lot of the information that Grant Williams and George Noble and Bennett Tomlin came up on. They've done tremendous forensic investigations along with a lot of governmental authorities of just what a con job Tether is. I mean, if you haven't read that Bloomberg article, I'd recommend it, or email us and we'll send you our Untethered EBA that we did. So to me, that's the concern, is that at some point, if there's a blow up in the stable, so-called stable coin, which I think is more like fable coin world, then that could really spill over. And if Bitcoin's extremely extended in price as it is right now, that's, and it's had these multiple crashes in its history. But I think the remarkable thing about Bitcoin that tells you there's something there is the first asset class, if you call it that, which I think it is now, was it at the time. But back in 2017, what got me writing my book called Bubble 3.0 was an enormous bubble in Bitcoin in 2017. It was at that point the biggest bubble of all time. Like all bubbles, it crashed and went down 80%. But what I've never seen happen before is that it's gone up and not only made a new high, it's basically tripled from what was like an outrageous point at, you know, 20,000 back in late 2017. So there's something to that I greatly underestimated. And I think that's kind of what he's picking up on. And I think the thing with bonds is, he's right. I mean, bonds are not performing their counterbalancing function to an equity portfolio any longer. The 60-40 portfolio that was, the champion for basically 40 years, I think is gone. I think that the 40% in bonds could actually be a risk enhancer rather than a risk mitigator, because if the problem is rising inflation on a secular basis, you're just going to lose money and lose money and lose money. And I think that's what, frankly, has to happen. That's how the Fed or the federal government needs to deleverage, is by keeping interest rates suppressed and running inflation hot. And they'll try to understate it, which they're already doing. We can get into that if you want. But I think that right now, the Fed, for most of the last 40 years, I think the inflation numbers have been reasonably accurate. But I think in the last couple of years in particular, they really started to diverge from reality. So that's the problem with bonds in a rising inflation period. And look at the 1970s. Bonds were, you were losing money on bonds at the same time that you were losing money on stocks. Now, I personally believe we're going into a decade that is more similar to the 1970s. And one of my colleagues on the GovCal side, Anatol Kaletsky, who is extremely highly regarded in Europe, and he's been mostly right about the macro environment over the last dozen years, he's saying this is going to be the 1950s. And that these policies that we're following are actually going to be vindicated. They're the right thing. And we're going to have low inflation and high growth. And I don't believe it. But we're running his overview as our guest newsletter this week. We try to show both sides of the argument.
You know, I think what you said about Tether is really important. I mean, it is just so obvious to me. The Tether stable coin, they've supposedly got a bank account in the Bahamas that seems very sketchy. The whole thing, to anybody who's looked at it in detail, it's just crazy. But you know what? If you look at the average Joe on the street, they're not listening to macro voices. They're not listening to you. You take somebody as famous, as infamous in the industry as Paul Tudor Jones, and there's a lot of other people that have been saying similar things. I can see very easily how you could get a trend going where a lot of retail investors are saying, boy, I should get rid of the 40% of my life savings that I've put into bonds, because all these guys are saying the bond market is crazy with what the government's doing. I should put it in something safe like Tether. That's what I should do. Right. And I mean, frankly, I shouldn't probably say this in the air, but I think that Mr. Tudor Jones should restrict his public comments to topics he understands, because although he is a far more accomplished futures trader than I'll ever be, I don't think he knows what the F he's talking about.
Well, he may be looking at charts, and I think that's the only way to really effectively trade Bitcoin is to use chart technical analysis and maybe extreme sentiment readings. So when people are in complete panic mode on Bitcoin, that's when you step in and buy it. But I personally think, and I am no crypto expert. I've got a great friend who is, and my big fear, as I've conveyed to him, is I think you're going to have a blow up of these other cryptos, the 99% that are absolutely, I'd call them, to be a little profane, I'd call them shit coins. I'm not the first one to refer to them that way. And there's an enormous amount of leverage involved. And then you got all these, as I call them, fable coins, the tethers. To me, it's like the classic speculative asset class in a very late stage bubble. So I think there's going to be an enormous shakeout in that space. And when there is, I think that's when you step up and buy Bitcoin and Ethereum, because I do think there is obviously persistent demand for these guys. There is a need. And I think it's a direct function of these extremely dangerous central bank policies in the Western world.
Well, and I think that it goes beyond the money printing. If you look at what's going on, Bitcoin really is a challenge to government-issued money. It is an effort to create private label money to replace government money. And that dramatically undermines the government's authority in many ways. And what governments are doing is laughing at it, saying, these silly little children think that their silly little currency is going to replace the U.S. dollar. Well, if they continue to ignore it, it really will. I mean, it is a better kind of money. They should have learned from it a long time ago, outlawed it, and figured out how to incorporate it in government-issued money. But they're not going to do that, and they're not apparently going to wise up to what's really going on here. If it continues much longer, it will reach a point of no return where, even though it didn't make sense, it will be impossible to stop it.
Well, I do think central banks in the West, or in China as well, are going to try to come up with some kind of digital coin of their own. How successful that will be, I don't know. I mean, obviously, it doesn't appeal to the people that feel like they're outside of the fiat or governmental controlled ecosystem. So I think that's going to be a big hurdle that they have to deal with in trying to popularize. I mean, they can come out with them, but can they actually make them popular is a whole other story. So I don't know, but I do think that it's here to stay. But I also think you're just going to have enormous volatility. You already have had. I mean, I guess to be like George Soros, I'm not predicting, I'm just observing. You know, there's just such a psychological element to these things. You're not getting earnings, you're not getting dividends, so the price is whatever the speculative crowd puts on it at a given time.
Let's move on to cryptocurrency's competitor, which is gold, the historical scarcity asset that you use it as an inflation hedge. Boy, the inflation that was predicted by the gold bugs happened, but the big run-up in gold prices predicted by the gold bugs hasn't really happened yet. We're just, as we're speaking on Tuesday, I'm looking at what might be another false breakout above the 100 and 200-day moving average, which are both co-located in the 1790s. We had a couple of daily closes above, but it looks like as we're trading right now, we're back down below those key resistance levels. Where is this all headed?
Well, I think gold is going higher, probably a lot higher, but it's not going to be, you know, like a straight shot. It's going to be the typical, you know, up sharply, you know, hard correction when their sentiment gets too bullish and, you know, just this back and forth, but, you know, jaggedly higher. But, you know, obviously last year they had an enormous move, gold and silver, particularly the miners. And I do think that is the better way to play. I mean, I'm not saying you shouldn't have some actual physical gold and silver, but the miners, just like with energy, it gives you a lot more bang for your buck, plus you get dividends. And these mining stocks are very cheap and they're generating a lot of free cash flow. They're also buying their own shares. So, you know, there was such a near-death experience with the mining stocks and with the energy stocks that these management teams, the guys that were the permabulls that have been, all been kicked out, the ones that are in there now are very careful stewards of shareholder capital, which is a good thing. So I think that's the way to play it. And they did have spectacular moves last year. We did a lot of profit taking during that. But at this point, I think the gold miners are back in accumulation mode. And I just think there's so much upward pressure that, I mean, if you look at foreign central banks, not the US, but foreign central banks, almost every single one of them is an aggressive accumulator of gold. And they're not aggressive accumulators of treasuries. Basically, foreign central banks have quit buying treasuries. So they're buying gold, they're not buying treasuries. And I think they're on the right track.
David, I want to move on to something that we've talked to your friend Louis Gav about in the past, which is GavCal, which is an institutional research firm, tends to break the economy down into quadrants. I know that you guys use that at Evergreen GavCal as well. First of all, explain, what are these quadrants? What do they mean? What does it have to do with anything? And how does that fit into your investment process?
Well, their belief is at any one time, the global economy is in either one of the four different categories. One is a deflationary or disinflationary boom, a deflationary, disinflationary bust, an inflationary boom, or an inflationary bust. And obviously right now, the question is, which is it from the inflationary standpoint? Are we in an inflationary boom or an inflationary bust? Interestingly, Eric, if you look at Google searches for stagflation, which would be the inflationary bust, those searches have gone ballistic in recent months, whereas inflation searches have gone way down. So it would tell you that, and you're starting to see this, including with energy, where you're getting some experts to say that because energy prices have gone up so much, we're going to have a recession next year. So again, that would be an inflationary bust kind of scenario, similar to what happened in the 1970s. That, I think, is the big question of the next 12 to 24 months. Which of those two quadrants is the global economy in? And at this point, I put myself in the inflationary boom category, but this isn't as high a conviction as some of my other calls. And the reason I believe that, I think this is a lot like after World War II, where the economy was basically shut down, at least the private sector economy is all focused on the war effort, and U.S. consumers built up a tremendous amount of savings. Coming out of World War II, a lot of people thought, oh, we're going to have, just like some people are saying today, a nasty recession, and you know, for the reasons of all those soldiers coming back with no jobs, and because the government wasn't going to be buying aircraft and aircraft carriers and so forth. And instead, we had a fantastic post-war boom. But with quite a bit of inflation. Inflation was running in double digits for a while in the late 1940s. And what that allowed to do, kind of back to one of our major themes of this call, this podcast, is it allowed the government to drastically deleverage from 1945 to 1952. By 1954, we had the debt to GDP down to about 70%. It had been about 120% at the end of World War II. And that's, I think, what we're going to see happen again, both the you know, fairly rapid economic growth, because we have $2.3 trillion of excess savings that consumers are sitting on that they accumulated because of all the excess of government stimulus and inability to spend, And you look at what's going on with the auto industry right now. I mean, it's in a nasty recession. And at some point, we're going to get cars again and people are going to buy cars again. So I do think that we're going to have a year to two of very good economic growth, but with a lot of inflation. And interestingly, too, Eric, that if you look at...
Well, wait a minute. Back up a second, David. Maybe I misheard, but did you just say you're expecting government deleveraging? You're saying that we're going to get responsible and pay down our debts?
Well, I wouldn't say responsible. This is a stealth form of default is high inflation, right? But it's already happening. It's already working again.
Okay, so you're saying deleveraging not by paying any debt down, but by inflating to the point that debt loses purchasing power.
Yeah, God forbid we would pay any debt down in with real money.
Well, it sounded like you were saying that for a minute there.
No, but if you look at what's happened to the debt to GDP over the last year, it's gone from 135% to 125%. So it's already happening. Now, there's no free lunch. Who loses in this? Well, it's just like who lost in... And the tremendous deleveraging in the U.S. actually lasted from 1945 to 1980, where we brought the debt to GDP down from about 120% down around 25% at the end of the 1970s. Those stagflationary 70s actually did the trick in turn. That's what allowed Volcker to be able to really crank up interest rates to 20%. So I know Luke Grohman believes that once we get debt down to more like 60, 70%, then finally the Fed can allow interest rates to go to something that's actually... truly a real yield. But, right now, I mean, the Fed would have to raise rates 400, 500, 600 basis points to get anything close to a real yield. And that ain't going to happen.
David, we've been talking about inflation, but I think it's really important to break that out. Are we talking about just prices? Is it ever going to be wage inflation where people actually get paid more that they can pay these new prices? And what's going to be the interplay between those? Because, there's different kinds of inflation, whether it's wage-driven or cost-driven and so forth. How is this going to play out?
Well, I think it's interesting to look at how it's playing out already and looking at what's occurring and just kind of following the trend. And obviously, there's a lot of wage inflation. What's interesting is the wage inflation is apparent everywhere except in the official data. And by that, I mean, if you look at like the Atlanta Fed's wage tracker, it's looking at 3 to 4%, but you look at the real world and it's just unbelievable. I mean, just one anecdote is there are nurses in the Seattle area that are getting paid $200,000 to $250,000 a year. And that's what happens when you have extreme shortages of essential workers. You start to get some unbelievable pay increases. I mean, you're seeing it all over the place in terms of union militancy, which is back. It's back both in the United States and in Europe. Strikes are happening and wage settlements are pretty amazingly high. I mean, you look at what Amazon is doing and all the inducements that they're offering to hire another 125,000 workers. I heard John Mackey, the founder of Whole Foods, still the CEO of Whole Foods, and he said they have 125,000 employees and they need 15,000 more employees. They got 15,000 job openings. Everywhere you go, it's help wanted. And I think that's one of the real fallacies of the inflation is transitory narrative, is that wages are very sticky. And there's a lot of upward pressure on wages, which I think is not fully played out. The other thing that hasn't fully played out is rents. Now, rents have been indicating very low inflation until lately. And the Fed's owner equivalent rent is really kind of a bogus thing. But regardless, rents are now starting to really kick in. So I think the Fed is going to have a problem, what I call the REW problem, RUE, of rents, energy, and wages as we go into 2022. And I think they're going to rue all the times they told us that was temporary inflation. So I think that's a big, big deal and a big, big change.
Well, David, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, I want to talk a little bit about what you do at Evergreen GavCal. You know, when we used to have Louis Gav on, the feedback we always got, the institutional audience loved him. But the complaint we got from our retail audience was, hey, I want to subscribe and it's only priced for institutions. I can't get it. Now, it sounds like the way GavCal has solved that problem is to merge or acquire, I'm not sure what the relationship is, or partner with your firm to essentially be their retail end. Does that give people access to GavCal's institutional research or some watered-down version of it? Or what's the product on offer there?
Well, that's great, great questions, a series of questions there. And we are partnered. We're not owned by, certainly not fully owned. We have a minority ownership with Louis himself. And we do offer some of the GavCal research. So it's a limited or, as you would say, watered-down version. But we also do a weekly newsletter. So once a month, sometimes twice a month, we actually publish some GavCal research. The rest of it is either something that I've written or we use guest sources, like a Luke Grohman or a Grant Williams, some of the brightest minds out there. We will run as a guest issue. And people can't complain about the price because it's free. So if somebody really wants to get at least partial access to GavCal, see what I'm thinking, what our firm is thinking, you can subscribe to our Evergreen Virtual Advisor. EVA is what it is for short. And I've been also publishing some of the chapters of Bubble 3.0, my new book, in that, because I really do believe, like I think you do, that this is the third bubble of the last 25 years. So that's a really good way to connect with us. And we obviously manage money for individuals. That's really our main thing. We're one of the few people that still does research. We are definitely not part of the passive investing herd these days. I think it's a great opportunity to actually think and do things differently. So that's a little quick overview of Evergreen.
Well, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Escrow.com is the payment system for buying and selling anything of value. Cars, boats, airplanes, jewelry, gemstones, fine art, collectibles, intellectual property rights, domain names, bringing in shipping containers from overseas, or even buying and selling entire businesses. It's simple to use. Either party sets up the transaction, then the buyer sends the funds to Escrow.com. The seller is then instructed to send the goods to the buyer to inspect. Within the inspection period, the buyer can return the items for any reason. After that, Escrow.com pays the seller immediately. Escrow.com is the world's most secure payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. Over 2 million customers have transacted over $5 billion on Escrow.com, and eBay and Shopify use it for cars, boats, luxury watches, and business sales. It's available in the United States, Canada, and Australian dollars, euros, and British pounds. Never buy or sell anything online unless you use Escrow.com. Escrow.com is a subsidiary of Freelancer.com, listed on the OTCQX Best Markets under the ticker symbol FLNCF, and the Australian Securities Exchange under the ticker FLN.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have David on the show. He really is a great macro thinker.
Patrick, I agree, and I think the greenflation theme is a very important one. I'm glad he coined that term. Let's go to our post-game chart deck now. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button that says Looking for the Downloads. Patrick, what is your thinking on these equity markets?
All right, Eric, let's start on page 2. Here we have the S&P 500. I just really want to highlight that the trend really has now broken out to the upside. And it wasn't just a short-term breakout for one day and then pops back down below, but this is a legit breakout. We talked about in our chart decks throughout late September and early October, asking whether this was just going to be a shallow market correction, and really has proven to be the case now. Really what will be interesting is to see whether or not all little corrections and consolidations can hold decisively at or above 4,500. What we're going to see under those circumstances is that the bulls will prove that they're decisively in control of this, and that really would open the window for easily another 3-5% upside potential in these markets. It'll be really interesting to see whether we have a year-end rally off of that. I mean, in order for these charts to start even beginning to look bearish, it would take a decisive breakdown day that starts wiping out 100 or 200 S&P points to the downside, just to do the technical damage to start making these markets look a little bit bearish. And that's therefore, it's really, we have to give the kudos to the bulls here and let us see where they're willing to take this. When we go to page 3, I just once again wanted to highlight the volatility index. We still have not broken to lower lows on volatility. And this is interesting because throughout this entire bull advance since the COVID crash, volatility's lows have generally been held to about the 15 handle. And in the prior to the COVID period, the VIX was as low as 10 to 12. This, we are at a sustained higher volatility premium. And it's interesting that we're seeing that. The question really is there a new breakdown in volatility coming where we can go back down to those lows? And that's something that's on my mind. So far, the lows from July continue to hold the bottom end of that range.
Patrick, the next few charts, you're looking at the euro and a few commodities. What's going on here?
Eric, I want to start off with that euro. The ECB just came out with their press conference and a very strong reaction to the euro. This is what caused that dollar index or drove that dollar index down 50 cents on when we look at the Dixie. At this stage, this is a really important moment. This entire euro consolidation, euro has been in a very clear decline from June all the way through October. And we really are seeing just the beginning of these bouncing markets. What we're interested to see is whether or not the euro legitimately is putting in a bottom and changing trend, or whether this is just a false start and euro weakness prevails. The dollar has been divergent from a lot of the different natural intermarket correlations that we're seeing in commodities and other assets. And so if the euro turns here, it would actually start to bring the entire intermarkets in line. And this is probably one of the more important charts to watch here in the coming week to see whether that becomes the unfolding in reality. Touching on to the crude oil chart that you were talking about earlier, there's that 2-3 day market correction that we've just been in. And it's interesting because, typically a solid $5 pullback has more or less been a pretty good short-term pullback for crude. It's a big question as to whether this is going to be a bigger or deeper correction or whether this is it. If this is a shallow flagging formation like we saw in the middle of October, then the bulls should get this back above 80. In a matter of just 2-3 trading sessions. I think that's what's on my mind, to see whether or not the bulls can actually fuel a new launch towards $90 if they can turn it here. The other chart that I wanted to just highlight in the commodity space was copper. And copper had been consolidating from May all the way through October in that downwards correction after what was a pretty distinctly pronounced bull market run through most of 2020 into the early part of 2021. After this consolidation, we had a really legitimate breakout on the upside of copper, retesting the May highs. With this pullback here, this is a really important moment to find out whether the bulls are willing to buy dips. And it'll be really interesting to see whether copper is actually turns here in price and whether this becomes a buy point. If it does, that certainly would continue to support the idea that there might be more upside on copper.
Patrick, starting at page 7, you have the 2-year yields from a number of countries. What's on your mind? How come with different countries?
Yeah, Eric, what an interesting price action we're seeing in the bond markets. You know, we were touching on that 10-year treasury yield earlier, even the 30-year treasury yield. We see actually yields backing off and things pretty quiet. But the higher inflation and the central bank tightening has really created a very strong move on the short end of the curve, particularly in the 2-year yields. And the interesting part is that this isn't a U.S.-specific story. What we continue to see is that the 2-year yields around the world are all skyrocketing higher. So while we see here that the 2-year yield has increased in the U.S. has increased from about 20, 25 basis points to over 50 basis points in a span of just a month. But when we go and look at page 8 and look at the Canadian yield, after a very hawkish Bank of Canada statement, yields have rocketed from 40 basis points to over close to 110 basis points. On the upside, when you go to Australian 2-year government bond yields, just a rocket of a 2-day move where we saw the yields go from 15 basis points to 45 basis points. You saw even in the German yields, even though they're still very negative, we're breaking now out of a 1-year range. And so we're seeing these short-term yields right across the board rising. But it's not the whole yield curve is rising. And that's the most interesting part. And I think to best illustrate this is to look at what's happening in the 5s-30s yield curve on U.S. Treasury. And you can continue to see the flattening is underway. And this is something that I think is at least surprised me a little bit. While I didn't necessarily think we had to have a huge steepener in play, but if you would imagine that if secular inflation was real, that the long-term government bonds would start to actually price long long-term inflation expectations higher, and that should at least have kept this relatively flat. And what we continue to see is that the belly of the curve continues to move so aggressively, and yet those long bonds are not responding, and that's continuing to create this flattener. Now, while the Fed and central banks around the world are more or less pinning the front of the curve, we are starting to see a lot of pressure to raise interest rates on it. This is a really interesting moment, and the way it's materializing the bond markets is something to continue to watch. It's something that I don't hear too many people talking about, and it really just is such a big move, at least on the shorter dated notes.
And listeners, you can get Patrick's chart decks not just once a week, but every single day with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The information is on page 13 of the slide deck, or you can just go to bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective, because the funds sit in escrow. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book that we just discussed in the post game. There's also a link to an interview with stock market wizard Mike Masters and an article discussing Marko Kolanovic. Did the world change yesterday? So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account @macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter @EricSTownsend, that's Eric spelled with a K, and myself @PatrickSerezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.